Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And the third member of our broadcast crew today is the fucking bird in the tree outside
of our surprised co-host. We can't decide if he liked the movie or not. He's very insistent, very strident, but does not seem to be leaning one way or the other.
Come to think of it, I'm not sure he went with us. So he might not have seen the movie.
No, although our movie, the crowd that we saw it with was so fucking chattery, I'm not sure that he would have stood out from the pack.
We're the Shock Doctors.
Awful lot of tittering and carrying on.
The subject of today's podcast is The Forever Purge. Now, you might be forgiven for wondering how there could be another Purge movie after how the third one ended, because the fourth one was a prequel. And I guess we'll get into that. But I'll front load this by saying it's not the most elegant setup.
No, I could tell that, and I haven't even seen Election Year. Is that the third one?
Election Year, Day, I don't remember. Yeah, Election something.
Election, yeah. It's I haven't seen, so I have a kind of complicated relationship with the Purge franchise. I've seen the first one, and I've seen the first Purge. So in a way, I have a very uncomplicated relationship with this franchise, because if someone asks me, have you seen the first Purge? I can just say yes. It doesn't matter which one they're referring to. But those are the only two that I've seen. So I skipped the second and third installment.
I, on the other hand, have seen every one of them. So I can offer a definitive ranking at some point later if we are so inclined. But anyway, to trot out one of my favorite phrases, if you've been living under a rock and you don't know the premise of the Purge franchise, the idea is that once a year, for 12 hours, like 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., all crime everywhere in the United States,
including murder, which the newscaster always stresses,
they take great pains to point this out, including murder, is legal continuously for that 12-hour period. You know, they carve out a couple of exceptions, like weapons above a certain level of, I don't know, explosiveness or whatever. Weapons above a certain grade.
We wouldn't last a minute on Purge night, clearly.
Well, if there was a Purge, maybe we would be more prepared. I don't know. But weapons of a certain
caliber?
I don't think it's even a caliber thing. Yeah. Because, again, I think it's like heavy weapons. Anyway,
the movie doesn't really specify, which is why we're coming up short a little bit.
Point being, certain weapons are still not permitted for use.
And certain government officials are exempt.
Not allowed to be murdered.
As Mel Brooks once said, it's good to be the king.
Right, exactly.
We obviously take this premise very seriously, which is why we have fled the country and are recording this episode in a rainforest. Or at least that's what it fucking sounds like. I kind of hope the microphone is picking it up, because otherwise we sound like crazy people.
If this is not audible, trust us, it's very loud outside from where we sit. So forgive our frustration. In any case, that's The Purge in a nutshell. And this is the fifth film in the franchise. There were three in a sort of trilogy. Then they did a prequel. And now they're plunging right on ahead with more movies kind of in the original timeline, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Forever Purge has an air of finality to it, although I would not put it past them to make one that's just called The Final Purge. That would be a nice bookend with First Purge, obviously. But then again, so would Forever.
Yeah,
hard to say. This franchise began so inauspiciously. The first one was such a dud, at least if you ask me, or I suspect Jim.
Oh, that, we've already had this conversation. Yeah. You know I don't like that movie either.
Yeah, well, so it's always hard for me to gauge whether it's running out of steam or not, because it sort of never had any steam to begin with, and then generated a certain head of steam.
Point being, we can get into a lot of this after the break, but The Purge is now a five-film franchise and could continue yet further. Then we'll just have to find out.
Yeah, and as far as fifth installments go, this is not the worst fifth installment of a horror franchise that I've seen. We open with a group of Mexicans being ferried illegally across the border. Their names are Juan and Adela, and they are instructed to, yeah, there's a lot of,
I mean, there are others too. When sure. when Matt says a group and then just says two people's names, we don't know the others' names. We don't see them again.
Yeah, no, uno, dos, it's just the two of them for our purposes and for the filmmaker's purposes. They're told a lot of subtitled Spanish, rápido, rápido. And then once across the border, they are instructed to follow the roses by the person ferrying them across the border. And it's not entirely clear to us what that means, but it will become clear in due time. We pick up 10 months later after the inelegant exposition credits dump that my co-host alluded to, where it's revealed that after having been ousted from power, the new founding fathers are reinstated and
yep.
get Purge Night rolling all over again like they never left, which is kind of how... how two-party systems work. You know, they're gone for a little while, but never permanently. You know?
Well, yeah, but the entire premise originally was that the new founding fathers
was
of America...
a third party.
Was a
yeah.
third party. It displaced the two-party system.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's, again...
Again, I don't know how election whatever ended, so...
More after the break.
But it sounded inelegant even to my ears.
Even just, to the uninitiated.
Just based on the newscaster preamble. I could tell that they were trying to get a square peg into a round hole a little bit.
Yeah, and the rest of the opening credits narration, when you take out the new founding fathers of America stuff, it just sounds like a regular newscast that you'd hear today. You know, like a darkest timeline. An editorial news broadcast. Like, hatred is rising in America.
Discord.
And, you know,
and
people are fed up and, you know.
No bipartisanship.
More polarization and violence.
Polarization,
and hatred,
that's the classic. Well, yeah, right. Could unity this, unity that. Could the Purge Night unite America?
No. The answer is no. The answer is obviously no. It was always going to be no. No.
So we catch up with Juan and a few other key characters. Juan is brought in to tame an unruly horse that a bunch of other cowpokes are having a hard time breaking in.
Yeah, most specifically the rancher's son, whose name is Dylan Tucker, played by Josh Lucas. His dad is Will Patton, and he is just Mr. Tucker.
Mr. Tucker to you, pal.
Mr. Tucker to everyone, including the credits. And, you know, Juan kind of shows up. Dylan, who originally tries to settle this horse down, and gets a kick for it, I believe.
Yeah, so it's something of a pissing match between the two of them, although really only on Tucker Jr.'s end. Juan doesn't have that kind of skin in the game.
Yeah, he's just like, I'm just doing my job, calming down this horse.
Well, it's funny, it cuts to, I think, Will Patton going, I know who can tame this beast. And then there's a very, like... Well, the filmmaking isn't really, but the music gets a little spaghetti western for a second mm-hmm. as Juan is reintroduced. He strides in, slow motion. Horse whispers the horse onto the ground. It's, you know, purring like a kitten for him, practically. Then enmity arises between him and the rancher's son.
Meanwhile, Adela works at some kind of meat processing plant. She seems to be kind of the second in command around there. She has a boss, but jokes about, like, you're lucky that I'm here to run the place. And
uh-huh.
like, yeah, no, I know. She's also kind of shepherding another young Latina woman through the process, because I guess she's only been in the country like a week and a half or something. And, you know, yeah, you're doing fine. Just remember this.
And Adela, relative to her husband, at least, has been very quick to adopt American customs and go with the flow. He's more, it's exactly the same dynamic from his house, actually.
Mm. Yeah.
It's inversed, inverted.
Right.
There was the husband
the
who was
swap.
More on board, right.
Yeah, she's frequently in the first act listening to an English language app, you know, a learning app. When they're at home and they're about to have dinner, he's speaking Spanish and she's chiding him, telling him, we got to practice, yeah. Speak English.
And that's just smart storytelling, I think, lest I sound like I'm accusing the new Purge of being derivative. It is a little bit, but also if you're telling a story about an immigrant couple fresh off the boat, they should be a little bit out of step with one another if they see things exactly the same way. They're functionally a unit, and that's just kind of boring, you know?
Right.
There should be some dissonance there. More dissonance on the farm where Juan works. First of all, the younger Tucker is giving him shit and just being a little bit of a racist shitheel across the board. you know, I don't know if I want my kids speaking Spanish under my roof because they've got a Mexican nanny or something. It took me a minute to grasp the family dynamics at play here. It's kind of a large clan, at least initially. Luckily, we don't spend the whole movie with all of them.
Yeah, I think there's, I think maybe, so Dylan has a wife and a sister who stick through the whole movie, but I think either he's got a brother and a sister-in-law, or he's got another sister and a brother-in-law, or maybe he's related to them through his wife, or who knows, but there's another couple there, and they have one or two kids, and they have a Mexican nanny, and like, I should introduce you to so-and-so's sister, she's great, and yeah, it's all, we don't need to meet her, no thanks, I don't even know if I, like Matt said, I don't even know if I want my kids speaking Spanish, and Will Patton's just kind of groaning about what a dickhead his son is being. But yeah, also, this prior scene, Josh Lucas is being just a dickhead, saying like, I heard you came in late today, I'm never late. Oh, you're never late.
To
so
Juan,
you're calling,
yeah. He's antagonizing him.
So you're calling so-and-so a liar. And of course, Juan can't say anything one way or another. I heard you left your lariat down. You know, shut the fuck up. But yeah, just a lot of this.
And the animosity cuts both ways because the ranchers have a couple of stable hands working for them. They give out stimulus checks, basically. They call them purge protection checks.
Right.
You know, on purge eve, go home. This is for your protection. Spend it wisely. And there's some muttering to the effect of like, oh yeah, I'm going to spend it, but not on protection. You know, they're going to suit up, basically, and go out and spill some blood. And maybe the rancher's blood specifically for class warfare reasons.
Right. So Juan and his buddy, there's another Mexican ranch hand, goes by the name or nickname TT. They kind of decamp. I think they split up at first, but they eventually reunite and go off to this compound where they've basically gotten a bunch of Mexican immigrants kind of camped out together
in a communal purge shelter guarded by men in SWAT gear.
Yeah, hired security basically. And meanwhile, the Tuckers hole up in their ranch, which has a lockdown button.
Yeah,
basically,
much
steel
like the
shutters,
house from the first Purge movie. They're pretty cushy, all things considered. They've done this before, not their first rodeo.
Right.
So Purge night passes uneventfully for all parties. The only close call we get is at one point Adela goes up on the roof of the communal Purge shelter and sees some white nationalist vans cruising, ranting through a megaphone about how they're disinfecting America.
Yeah, purge, purification, something.
Uh-huh. And then the following morning, back to business as usual, or so it seems. Adela goes to work. Juan goes to work. Everybody wakes up, and there are a few telltale signs that something might be awry, and then a very major, unignorable sign in the form of a newscaster getting capped during a live broadcast.
Yeah. One of the ranch hands who had been grumbling about, oh, well, they just get so they can get our slave labor, her, gathers up a group of other yokels, and they all show up in their edgelord masks.
To massacre the bourgeoisie, to take out their local Romanovs, basically. Says everything. He has a long monologue right about now. Says everything short of, we have nothing to lose but our chains. There is a specter haunting El Paso. they're not in El Paso yet. They will be.
There's some smaller Texas town we've already forgotten the name of. But meanwhile, Juan and TT are going to work. And, you know, they see some chaos on the way, but they just figure, oh, well, you know, it's, when I say chaos, it's really more just debris.
Aftermath.
Yeah. And so they're heading into work. They don't think anything of it yet. And then eventually they see kind of what's going down. And they pull out their guns and also retrieve some guns from, like, the garage and rescue most of the Tuckers. Mr. Tucker gets probably the big, showy, eat shit line.
Yeah, well, they have to yank the gag out of his mouth, and then they very obligingly listen to him go on for multiple sentences about how they're hypocrites because they're just doing the government's bidding. And for all their talk about sticking it to the powers that be. They're at the beck and call of those fat cats in Washington.
Well, he does lull them into a false sense of security for a minute, because he starts out saying, like, you know, you're right. You're talking about life in America, and the rich have everything, and the poor don't have anything. But you know what? And then goes into all of that you just mentioned, and then the takeaway is, like, from my family to yours, go fuck yourself, and this earns him a bullet through the head.
Yeah.
At which point, Juan and TT leap into action and manage to rescue the rest of the family, kill a few forever purgers.
Including the main one, who I mistook for this movie's, like, primary antagonist, because he and Juan have a relationship. You know, they have, like, a scene earlier on, which I talked about, where he talks about, oh, I'm not going to spend it on protection. And then he walks off and Juan goes, crazy man, in Spanish, subtitled, something, something, pendejo.
It's pendejo again. It's always pendejo.
It's always pendejo. Yeah, more on that later. So, meanwhile, Adela has her own altercation with purge psychos. She goes to rescue a caged goat in an alleyway, and she reaches inside to operate some mechanism to spring the trap loose.
Why would you ever do this?
Trapping herself in the process. I have to say, as far as jigsaw-style traps go, it trumps anything in Spiral. More inventive.
It is, but it's still like, why are you sticking your head inside of a cage to reach for a lever, the mechanics of which you do not understand because you're not familiar with the machine?
Yeah, that's true. You could lose a finger just because you don't know what you're doing. Although, for me, the main point of contention is more like, I could understand being this complacent the morning after Purge Night if it was my 10th Purge Night, but not my first.
Right.
She should be a little more shaken up and a little more wary, I would think. Although, she does more than once allude to the fact that they came from a rough area in Mexico and she's not unused to the sound of gunfire. So maybe she's not so... Maybe she's pretty unflappable, which I guess is a consistent characteristic of hers.
Well, okay, she's unflappable, but that should also, like, make her maybe cautious.
Yeah, no, it is a foolhardy thing to do, and she pays the price, or nearly does. She gets sort of flipped over onto the top of the cage by this gizmo and positioned in such a way that a No Country for Old Men-style cattle killer is gonna ka-thunk her in the head, but in a almost James Bond fashion. It's like getting a little closer. It's like the laser in Goldfinger. It's right. Not gonna get her right away. It's gonna get her eventually, after someone has ample time to intervene, and that someone happens to be her boss.
Yeah, her boss, Darius, shows up, starts beating the shit out of one guy, and then another guy gets it loose.
Crew of guys dressed up like blood-spattered bunnies, like psycho bunnies, because I guess clowns are passé at this point.
Again, more after the break, but the edgelord shit that these people wear has bugged me from day one.
Yeah, they're not to be taken seriously.
Anyway, they eventually get loose and they have to kill these guys because it's kill or be killed. The cops happen to show up and they've already seen some shit going down, people still purging, and so they assume that's what's happening here. And it was, but they mistake who the victims are and arrest Adela and Darius, put them in the back of a van with
the world's
crazy woman
skinhead.
an insufferable skinhead, even insufferable by skinhead standards, I would think. Not that I know any.
A skinhead, an extremely loquacious skinhead circus strongman from the looks of him. Just a brute who fancies himself a silver-tongued intellectual because he just pontificates ad nauseum about how Purge Night ain't over yet and we're gonna retake the streets and you hear that gun out there, that's a such and such, you hear that gun, that's a different kind of gun.
He identifies no fewer than like 8 different firearms and then talks about how this is a down home American symphony.
That's American music.
And there's no such thing as crime anymore. Let me the fuck out. And the cops, of course, like, shut the fuck up. You know, fuck, fuck, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you.
He was annoying. I was more annoyed by the girl that's locked up with him. Well, she is like the giggly airhead, like squeaky Fromm kind of archetype who, you know, like a sub, like Harley Quinn almost kind of like.
Yeah.
I hate that shit.
Yes.
There's just nothing to that character 9 times out of 10. And in point of fact, there is nothing to her, and she's about to die, so I guess no harm, no foul.
He just talks more.
Yes.
So I guess by volume, like once you factor the volume in, he's the more irritating. But per
at one point he does say, "Strike up the band," and I thought that was kind of funny. But that's one okay line in a monologue that goes on for multiple minutes.
Right.
So no points for that. In general, the villain monologues are pretty weak. I didn't like the angry proletariat from the first act either.
Yeah. No.
But anyway, the van goes sideways. Everything starts kind of going sideways right about now. There's a crash. The woman, the tittering ninny purger, gets her neck broken. Everyone else survives. Well, the cops croak, but everyone else in the back survives.
Because they took like an RPG to the front of the van.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, that's why the cops are toast.
So Adela and her boss have an altercation with the skinhead, and they
eventually
manage
Darius
to...
breaks the dude's fucking neck, which is pretty hardcore.
Yeah, good on him. And then they hear banging on the outside of the van, you know, come out, come out. And they think that purgers are upon them. Turns out it's Juan to the rescue.
Well, and, no, I think it's purgers at first, and then Juan and the Tuckers, who have fled the ranch in like a semi sans trailer, have showed up and killed the purgers outside and let them out.
So then everyone, with the exception of Adela's boss, who goes off by himself to save his family. I thought for sure, I was getting ugly flashbacks to Quiet Place Part 2.
Oh.
It's the exact framing, like Jimon Hunsu's death, where
he's like,
what about my family? And then he dies. Like the moment he makes a mistake, such a thankless role.
I was waiting for him to be standing there for too long and just get a stray bullet in the head.
Right, right, mid-sentence.
And then after he doesn't die and clears frame successfully, I just assumed, because every time there's a setup like this where they don't die immediately, they're the cavalry.
Right.
You know, they're going to
show up and save the day in 40 minutes.
He never shows up again.
Right, which is two expectations subverted, which I guess is not that bad. I mean, there's never a moment later on where they need a cavalry that doesn't show up. They just arrange for different cavalries to be on hand.
Right.
So it's not the end of the world. I would have liked to have seen more of him, I guess, but it's no great loss. So everyone else goes to a gas station to refuel and forage for supplies. They hear a news broadcast to the effect of Canada and Mexico have opened their borders for the next 6 hours. So if you want to flee Purge Night, it's this grassroots movement, apparently. It's this viral idea spreading on social media. You know, Purge Night forever, Purge Night ever after is what they keep chanting. I wish they had settled on a different mantra, because every time they said ever after, I just thought of that fucking Cinderella movie where she's friends with Da Vinci. Not a very threatening...
We'll get into the terminology after the break also, because it's...
Forever Purge. That sounds better. That's why it's the title.
It's nonspecific. It's diffuse, to use one of our recent favorite terms.
Yeah, it's an awfully handy one.
Yeah, we can get into that. But,
so, seis horas to make it to the border. So they start hightailing it for El Paso.
Harper, Dylan's sister, while they're at the gas station, finds this like Forever Purge flag basically and concludes, oh well, you know, this was planned in advance. I'm like, well, that seems relatively clear.
Yeah,
you
it know, took some all orchestration.
The white supremacist vans Matt alluded to. Seems pretty definitive. But anyway, she thinks to take that with them, and it turns out it's going to be useful almost immediately. Because as they're getting relatively close to El Paso, they nearly get waylaid by a group of guys on motorbikes, which for the most part just made me wonder, like, run them off the fucking road. You're in a goddamn semi.
Well, it's okay. So the movie looks for a minute like it's ramping up to a Fury Road set piece. And I was quite enamored of that idea. I was like, okay, that's taking this franchise in a kind of different direction. I'm here for that. Been fucking 6 years since that movie came out. I'm hard up for Mad Max flicks. And I guess unfortunately for the audience, but fortunately for the characters, they managed to defuse the situation by waving the
throwing the flag up in the window and shouting like, Forever Purge! Woo!
Ever after!
And like, oh, she's with us! Okay, let's go! And okay, dumb motherfuckers.
Right, that's all it takes. Gotta fly the friendly colors. So they make it to El Paso. And for my money, this is the strongest stretch where they have to get out of the car. I can't remember if it breaks down or if there's a blockade of some kind.
It's a little both, really.
Yeah, they have to go on foot the rest of the way, and the window is shrinking. There's like less than 2 hours to go. So they're shooting people in the streets, sticking to the shadows. Everything's on fire.
Incidentally, the new founding fathers of America, and I think this comes through in the news broadcast at the gas station, martial law has been declared, and
yeah, this
military
was not sanctioned by Washington.
Yeah, at least not openly, and we can get into my theorizing also after uh-huh. the break. But yeah, so the army's going into like every major metropolitan area to try and restore order, and El Paso is no exception. So there are literally tanks in the streets, and there's kind of three factions going on. There's the army, the forever purgers, and regular citizens who are just trying to survive or trying to flee to Mexico.
So they start, after making it through a movie theater that is playing Dracula, the Bela Lugosi Dracula, and this five-minute stint is just like a straight-up haunted house, complete with, is that an alive guy or is that a mannequin? It could not be any more Halloween haunted house if it tried. I find that kind of sweet. So after that brush with danger, they start following the roses graffitied on walls throughout El Paso. There are roses, which, if you know to look for them, lead you to safe havens if you're a recent transplant, an immigrant, you know, a Hispanic, Latino person.
Now, incidentally, the group had to split up at the entrance to the theater because there's an explosion, and it's after a couple people make it inside, and then, you know, the door gets blocked. So it's Adela and Cassidy, Dylan's wife, are inside, and they're the ones traversing through the haunted house and then going on. And then Juan and TT and Harper, Dylan's sister, are making their way around, and they run afoul of some forever purgers
mm-hmm.
who, there's got to be four people left in this group.
Well, there's TT.
Yeah, there's TT.
The sister.
Sister, Juan, and Dylan. Okay, yeah, I forgot about Dylan. Either way, there's four in this group, and they get cornered by forever purgers, and they go on their typical America First racist hodgepodge
another
rant.
Kind of bad villain monologue.
Right. And they're presented with the deal, like, you white folk kill the brownies. That's literally the term they used.
Yeah.
Which was pretty fucking weak sauce.
Be a little bit toothless.
Kill them and, you know, redeem yourselves and go on, live in peace in our great country, or we're just going to kill the lot of you. And even the fucking racist shitheel, Dylan, who's, I guess, less of a racist than these ones,
uh-huh.
comes right out and, you know, gives him the old Mr. Tucker treatment, you know, fuck you.
He makes his paw proud. That's my boy.
Looking down from on high.
Uh-huh.
So, in retaliation, TT gets shot, because, of course, he does. He's the expendable one.
Yes, he's the most expendable character with a darker complexion. It wasn't going to be the sister.
Yeah, he has no familial attachments
right.
to the group.
So he's the sacrificial buddy. Lamb, to let you know the movie means business. And then the cavalry shows up, but it's not Adela's boss. It is the new founding fathers of America.
Yeah, it's the army. They start getting in a crossfire with the purgers, the remaining members of the group. The good guys, the protagonists, take advantage of the chaos. One of them, I think it's Dylan, shoots the head honcho's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And they all flee and they leave TT behind because he has died from his gut wound.
So El Paso has fallen. We get this courtesy of more news broadcasts. We see a military somehow, base in absolute shambles.
There's a massive explosion. I guess the fucking forever purgers got their hands on a high quantity of plastic explosive or some shit.
Well, unfortunately, in situations, this I'll give them some slack. I'll cut them some slack on this, just because in situations like this, you can't trust everyone in the armed forces to be ideologically aligned with not the insurrectionists.
True.
You know, it could have been an inside job, potentially.
Like 9/11.
Yeah, or, well, hate that I agreed with that just so flippantly.
Well, you know, I said it so reasonably.
Yeah, yeah, that's the danger. Let that be a lesson to you all.
Jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
That's, yeah, well, hey, no one's contesting that. No reasonable person would disagree.
Chemtrails.
With that assertion, yeah. Oh boy. So, in response to El Paso falling to the purgers, Mexico closes its doors. We see that
at that particular crossing.
Yes, the official border crossing in El Paso is out of commission. So
the rest of their border crossings are presumably still open for the next 90 minutes or however long they have left until the original deadline.
So somewhat cleverly, now the film has come full circle. They now have to cross the border into Mexico through unofficial channels. So
they've all made their way, again, using the roses. Both halves of the group pick up on the rose thing, and they make their way to a safe house with a group of immigrants who have some kind of relationship with a Native American tribe whose leader we've seen on news broadcasts a couple different times.
Oh, that was him. Yeah, I didn't connect those dots. That's right.
Talking about the purge is a poison, it's a cancer, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, this country's going to tear itself apart. It doesn't pacify people. It creates more hatred. No shit.
Right. So he gets summoned, essentially, and he shows up with a truck and is going to take all of the people in this safe house to the reservation where there's a place that they can cross because it's not governed by Mexican or American law. And there's also a section.
Yeah. There's a gap of missing wall because the terrain is too rough.
It's mountainous. So.
So they make it there. The film once again teases what might have been a Mad Max set piece, but then doesn't evolve into one. They're being pursued by a convoy of purgers.
And led by
the bereaved
right
widower from before, the one with the third crappy villain monologue.
Right.
So there's a shootout first at the reservation, and then they retreat into the hills to this Alamo-type fortification. And this is funny for reasons I'll get into after the break. There's some action there that's a little bit muddy, and climax-wise, I found a little bit of a letdown. And then the trail of the people fleeing across the border, including what's-his-name's wife, who's expecting. I don't know if we even mentioned that.
Oh, yeah.
Dylan's wife is very pregnant, going into early labor, and so she's being pulled on a kind of sled along with the other refugees. And let's see, the main purger dude who lost his wife in the last shootout gets his hands on Adela and is threatening to slice her throat, and she's hurling abuse at him in Spanish, which he doesn't understand, which I thought was pretty funny. And he's yelling at her to speak English at knife point, and she's not obliging him.
Yeah, he's telling her to call out for help, or I'm going to cut your throat.
And she's saying, shouting, kill, like,
kill this fucking pig. Yeah. Sure enough, eventually, after all of his fucking minions are dead, Juan and Dylan kind of teaming up with lariats, crucially.
Uh-huh, yeah, lassos.
Getting the lassos out. They team up. Juan gets the dude around the neck. Dylan gets his rope around the guy's rifle and yanks it away.
And they bring him to cowboy justice together because they're both cowboys, and they're both equally good cowboys now on the basis of this action scene.
And Dylan is no longer a racist.
And then Juan comes over to their quarry and says something in English, like,
does this translate?
Pendejo. And then gives him one between the eyes.
Right.
So we know that Dylan has been cured of his racism, because once they make it into Mexico, he's, first of all, very obsequious and thankful with their indigenous farrier. And is that a word? Ferryman, whatever.
Right.
And he then is running frantically through town going, hospital, hospital, medico, medico. You know, speaking Spanish for the first time ever in a moment of panic and emotional duress. And then he finds the little medical pavilion and finds his wife has given birth. The child looks healthy. She looks healthy. Everything's swell. We then go out with more news broadcasts.
And the capper is Juan and Adela show up, and They're thanking each other, kind of, and Dylan very pointedly, like, gracias, Juan. Muchas gracias.
Yeah, laying it on a little thick. Does everything except, like, play castanets afterwards. So we then get one more news broadcast exposition dump, every bit as clunky as the one during the credits. And the final clunker is 2 million American refugees stranded in Mexico. What will become of these American dreamers?
Yeah. So, all right. And they say it twice. I don't think you heard the first time.
No.
But it's earlier on, like.
Well, because it's doing thing where they layer in a bunch of voices, but the second of the two comes through loud and clear. It's impossible to miss.
Yeah, the first one is like, the president of Mexico, what are they going to do with these? Calling them American dreamers, citizenship, blah, blah, blah. But then, yeah, later it's.
Phrase American dreamer is kind of like white trash. You know, it's like we have to designate, you know, that this is a different. They're not just dreamers. These are American dreamers. Damn it. These aren't just poor people. These are white poor people. these ones matter. I don't know. I just did a weird little semantic. But yeah, as I said, it's a bit of a clunker, and that's the note that the movie goes out on.
Yeah, they're talking about groups of regular Americans are banding together to fight back against the forces of the new forever purgers, purification, whatever the fucking jargon is,
yeah.
And saying how the new founding fathers of America have been destroyed by the monster they created.
Yes. So they should have been playing Frankenstein in that Spook House movie theater.
Yeah, exactly.
Been a little more apropos. It kind of has the same ring as reverse racism, as though, like, racism has a designated direction and to redirect the stream is somehow perverse.
Right.
American dreamer. Anyway, more on that maybe after the break.
Help me! The purge is over, please!
No, it ain't.
This is insane. Nobody hear the sirens?
There's no crime anymore. Anything goes.
You rich can't hide behind your steel walls no more.
Powerless. How's that feel?
It's the real purge. The forever purge!
They're coming!
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
This country's gonna collapse.
Mexico is opening its borders for the next 6 hours.
Let's go.
We're in this together.
And we're back. So it's become something of a habit recently, but I think going back quite a ways, really, on this podcast, for us to complain about jargon. Most recently, 2 episodes ago, in our review of The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It.
Yeah, where you need a fucking Ed and Lorraine Warren glossary open in your lap, but it will not avail you because they changed the definitions on you willy-nilly.
In this movie, there are 2 kinds of jargon that I want to complain about. And really only 2 kinds of jargon, period, unless you want to count being able to identify a bajillion different kinds of guns, which I'm not for these purposes. But the first thing is, what are we calling this purge? You would think, judging by the title, namely The Forever Purge, that they would just call it The Forever Purge. It's serviceable, it's sturdy, it works, but instead...
It's on the damn poster.
Right. Instead, we're constantly yo-yoing between The Forever Purge, The Forever After Purge, The Ever After Purge, and at one point, our resident Bolshevik ranch hand refers to it as The Eternal Purge, which has kind of a nice ring to it, but they don't stick to it. And I agree with Matt, The Ever After Purge, or just shouting Ever After, is definitely the weakest of those four options.
It's easily the wimpiest one, and it's the one that they parrot the most often.
Honestly,
nothing like,
more
like a bunch of Hell's Angels looking dudes on motorbikes going, yeah, Ever After.
I love Drew Barrymore.
Drew Barrymore, I love that shit. That movie's a classic.
Why can't they just stick to one? I wouldn't have been happy if they stuck to one.
Angelica
and
Houston, fuck yeah. 10 out of 10. Two thumbs up. Yeah.
If they had just stuck to one and it had been Ever After, but at least there would have been some consistency. Instead, they're just flipping back and forth. They can't settle on a name. And yeah, there's a sense that this is, you know, a grassroots thing, so there's going to be some inconsistency. But at the same time, there is a driving force. There is some kind of scheming, covert organization kind of pushing this thing along. And you'd think that they would have picked a name for this thing and just stuck to it and popularized it on, you know, fucking Reddit, 8chan, etc., etc.
Well, you know, real grassroots movements, or even, you know, astroturfed movements, can have mixed messaging problems. But for the purposes of streamlining it for a motion picture, you really ought to get your story straight most of the time, unless your movie is about infighting amongst activists or revolutionaries, which is valid. But
that's not what this
is. No, in this movie, the antagonists are more or less a cohesive whole.
Yeah, they're supposed to be monolithic.
Right. Yeah, monolithic is exactly the right word for it. And yeah, them just saying Ever After. Pretty sure Angelica Houston played the wicked stepmother in that. I haven't seen it since I was a little kid. But yeah, it's the worst of all possible options. And a good slogan goes a long way. You know, Wakanda Forever still has some heft to it. You know, I mean, it's people took to saying that for a reason. It sounds nice. Ever After Purge, or Purge Ever After, or what have you. Just doesn't roll off the tongue. It wouldn't pass muster as a serial slogan. It wouldn't any kind of marketing group think tank is the word I was going for, the phrase I was going for. It's not ready for prime time.
Wouldn't pass the focus group.
Focus group, thank you.
Yeah. So that's irritating. And there's also the fact, and I'm going to build into a broader criticism of the franchise here, but the other thing, jargon-wise, that irritates me is we've got the new Founding Fathers of America, but we've also got the whatever the hell you want to call these forever purgers.
The new Founding Fathers.
The purge, purification, whatever.
They call them forever purgers much of the time.
Right. And again, it's just more fucking jargon we have to try and remember. But more to the point, why do we need two sets of villains here? The new Founding Fathers of America are the bad guys. And insofar as either group is interesting, and spoiler alert, neither one is really that interesting. But out of the two, I definitely take the original. Because this shit, it's all obviously just rednecks. And I mean, that's so tedious. And it's not like pointing out that the rich and powerful are also hostile to minorities and outsiders, even if they're quieter about it. That's not groundbreaking in the slightest.
No, not by default, anyway.
But it's at least, even now, marginally more interesting than, yeehaw, I hate Mexicans.
Well, and speaking of just jargon issues or vocab murkiness or vocab deficiencies, you talked about before the break how annoying it is that they keep saying brownies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kill the brownies and we'll let you go. So we're talking about like Girl Scouts selling brownies door to door, like pot brownies. Like what kind of? It just sounds so fucking weak and toothless. And I really, much of the violence in these movies, you know, you'll see people eat a bullet right in front of you, but it's mostly clean bullet holes. You know, nice and circular. Not a lot of brain matter. There'll be like one squirt out of the back of the skull, but there's not any carnage that's going to turn your stomach. And I feel like with a series predicated on this premise, you kind of need, you know, like one scene per movie that's genuinely nauseating would be good, just to make like the tittering teenagers in the audience shut up and kind of take notice.
Our audience could have used that, boy howdy.
Yeah, every once in a while they clammed up, but it wasn't meant to last.
The highlight, I think, or the low light, depending on how you want to look at it, of audience chatter that I overheard tonight.
I wonder if it's the same one for both of us.
So. We'll find out in a minute. The morning after, when the purge has continued past its expiration hour, one member of the group behind us was confused, and his friend very helpfully pointed out to him, well, you know, the purge is over, but I think the purge is like forever now.
Ever after, you know? No, it was the same group of...
Of course it was the same group, because they were the 90% of the problem.
Yeah, same bunch of jackasses. No, the first purge night slang that we see, one of them went, oh, one down! Yeah.
Fucking duh.
That guy's getting his money's worth.
He's just... Got a sheet of paper finally, making tally marks.
A purge night that lasts forever. I never have to think again.
It's just like... What? But it's like forever now. Did you not get that from... what movie title did you think you were going to see? Did you just like, I want to see Purge. Give one Purge, please.
Ticket for new Purge.
Did you not know what this fucking movie's called?
Kudos to him in this age of spoilers if he has just goes through life blindfolded and is like totally unaware. It's like, God, that was short. Wow, Purge night over already, huh? Well, golly. Okay, well, won't have to pay for parking, at least. But the stupidity of the average American moviegoer is the one thing that makes me okay-ish with them saying American Dreamers twice, and with all of the very heavy-handed. Because this is, if it's for multiplex audiences, you do need to ladle it on with a fucking big ladle sometimes to get through to some of these people. I can be a bit of a rube myself sometimes, but anyway, where's I going? Oh, the clean bullet holes and the lack of impactful carnage reminded me of the lack of impactful hate speech. You know, we're talking about frothing at the mouth, murderous vigilante racists, like gonna string you up, KKK racists.
And brownies.
Brownies is the best
I think they can come up with. I think at one point... And it's a little bit muffled because after TT gets shot, we go into one of those, like, some of the audio falls out, like, high-pitched whine tension audio cues, you know? So we can't hear it that clearly. But I think the dude's wife who gets shot eventually by Dylan might throw out the word beaner.
I didn't catch that, but I believe you.
And, like, okay, yeah, that's gross. But it's one, it's muffled, and it's still... not by the standards of the sorts of people these guys are supposed to be, not as heinous as it could be. The instance that, and this whole discussion makes it sound like we're just clamoring, more slurs!
Well,
but
the people demand it.
But the one that jumped out to me was the skinhead in the van when they're tussling, and I think he calls Adela a puta, or something.
Right.
But
so he's cool. He's more cool with bilingualism than fucking Dylan is.
Right. But he does that, number one. But then Darius gets in on the act when he gets free and he's starting to help Adela fight the guy. And Darius is a black guy, and I figured it was fucking textbook for a skinhead.
He's
literally
got
a swastika on his cheek.
His face.
Doesn't drop the N-word. I figured that was a no-brainer. And just nothing.
Yeah, because dude's got him in a chokehold. It could have been muffled. I'm not going to try to emulate what I think it might have sounded like. But,
well, and even before that, he's like, Darius tries to hit him, and the guy, like, shoves him off.
And all he says is, get the fuck off me. They sound like siblings. You know,
yeah.
They sound like they're tussling, like, at a slumber party. Like tempers flared at a Cub Scout meetup.
I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it didn't.
So
I mean,
get
like,
the fuck off me, I'm gonna tell mom. Like, that's
right.
That's the attitude.
So, yeah, again, racial slurs are bad. We don't like them.
No, I want to have a worse time when I go to a Purge movie. I don't want it to go down
smooth.
Quite so smooth and be
right.
Quite so easily
digestible.
It should
be abrasive. it should be unpleasant. That's kind of the idea.
Because if
that's our beef.
Because if it goes down too smooth and it is too digestible, then it's counterproductive with its messaging. Then,
right.
Then if it makes Purge Night look like an okay time, then you're in trouble artistically and ideologically.
Right. And thankfully, after the first 40 minutes or so, this kind of drops away. It's much more a prominent feature in prior Purge films. The edgelordy costumes are very tedious. The two that leap immediately to mind are, and I think we talked about both of them already, but we talked a little bit more at length about the pair of reprobates who spring the trap on Adela. Have these, they're like Donnie Darko rabbit
but
things.
But they're like fluffy white Easter bunnies.
But they're fluffy white Easter bunnies, except they have just like red blotches for eyes.
Right, so they're not even macabre, American McGee looking Donnie Darko bunnies, which I might have been able to respect.
They might as well be Easter Bunny masks with red orbs slapped over the eyes. Those are very dopey looking. And then Comrade Trotsky has this one of those like grinning skull mouth masks that he eventually takes off, and everybody's like, it's you.
Yeah, he looks exactly like the villain in Metal Gear Solid 5. Before he takes that thing off, and he has to take it off because he has a lot of speeches to deliver,
right,
about you know, the working man.
And those are just dumb. And like I said, I'm glad that mostly tapers off. Pretty much everybody from then on is just done up in camo and bandanas or nothing, and that's better, because one stupid thread even through some of the Purge movies that I liked better than others, everybody just wears dopey get-ups, goofy politician masks, or
like Point Break style, like,
right, or Uncle Sam masks.
Uh-huh.
There's probably some Guy Fawkes masks in there somewhere.
There would be in real life. That's for damn sure.
For damn sure. skull masks with like fucking, I don't know, LED lights strung through. A lot of dumb edgelord shit. And I'm glad that that tapered off. If they do make another one of these movies, hopefully the way they kind of disappeared out of this movie means that they won't show up at all in that movie. And that will at least be a minor victory.
Well, it depends on the milieu, I think, because as we get deeper into this movie and closer to the border, the Purgers get more Dixie fried, more, you know, as you see more red, white, and blue, more Confederate flags. They do phase out the Halloween costumes, and that, as I agree with you, that is a blessing, although I think that's easier because the movie is set in Texas, and I think Texas is a fairly interesting backdrop for all of this to play out against, because there is, you know, a gun culture in America and in red America more so, and in Texas extremely so. And so, remember the Alamo, and we're gonna secede, you know, there's already kind of a revolutionary atmosphere in the air down there. And, you know, if you go to Austin, like kind of a Civil War atmosphere, because it's very contentious, like culture clash, culture war. So I think that's all well and good. I mean, if you have a whole, you have a whole country to play with here. I'd like to see a Purge movie set in Alaska or Hawaii. That would be kind of interesting. But even if it's just the other 48, you know, mainland America, that's a big play box. That's a big sandbox to play around in.
Playpen.
Yes. Thank you. And I'm glad to see a little bit of geographic diversity there. I think that Ted Cruz actually did implement a temporary Purge Night during all the power outages this past winter just to boost morale for a week or two. It's a controversial decision, but that was when he fled to Cancun or whenever.
Right. So I guess now is as good a time as any to do my minor treatise on the arc of the Purge franchise.
Mm-hmm.
The first Purge movie is pretty lame, and the issue with that is that they draw up this high concept premise of the Purge and what it means, and that's a recipe for widespread chaos. Like, that's inherent to the idea. And then what do they do in the first Purge movie? They constrain it within the bounds of a single house. They turn it into a home invasion movie, and that was just a brain-dead fucking screenwriting decision.
Well, I'm sure it was budgetary in part, but yeah, it turns into like a lazy retread of The Strangers or something of that ilk.
Well, right. But I mean, even the subsequent movies, I don't think their budgets were dramatically larger. I think there were ways you could do broader chaos without spending maybe not no more, but not too much more than they ended up spending on the first movie. In any case, whatever the decision was motivated by, it was a bad one.
Yes, I agree. And it all built to this kind of hackneyed, and I fucking love the Twilight Zone, fucking love, you know, Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. So I will roll over like a tame horse for, you know, for most iterations on that theme. But that first Purge movie built to a really obvious, really heavy-handed, don't trust the neighbors kind of thing, where it turns out that they were the ones behind the mask the whole time. You know, oh, and it's not such a pleasant little suburb after all. Whatever. Been there, done that.
Right.
And that's what really makes the microcosmic quality of that movie feel even more annoying, is that it does have a big point it's trying to get across. It's just nothing special.
Right. The first sequel, The Purge Anarchy, the subtitle is apt because it fixes that fatal error of the first film and widens it out. It follows like a cop or an ex-cop trying to get across town to protect his kids and his ex-wife, maybe, or just his wife. Anyway, plot details are not important. It's got everything you would want to have in a movie with this premise. There's varied interactions with crazy purgers and some gore involved, and there's good stuff going on. It's fun. It's, again, everything you want in a Purge movie. And Election Year, I think it's called, Election Something, the third movie, is more of the same, a little bit diminishing returns. But the upshot of that one is that there's a woman running to be elected president against the NFFA candidate, whoever that is. We don't even know who that is, I don't think. Doesn't matter. And she wins. That's how the movie ends. And so that's supposed to be it. The forces of sanity have won out. She runs on a platform of ending the Purge, and she wins. So the Purge is supposed to go away. The fourth movie is a prequel. It's called The First Purge. Guess what it's about?
The cleverest idea introduced in that movie, and what took me in, you know, what got me interested in that movie, just based on the trailers and the marketing, was the idea that the inaugural Purge was gonna be something of a misfire because people were mostly just keeping their heads down.
Right.
And so they had to bring in these like Blackwater goons to pose as psycho rage clowns and stir up trouble to make it look like it had been more of a success than it actually was, and to liquidate some lower income areas, at least in theory, until, you
and,
know.
And those areas were also not coincidentally predominantly black areas.
Yeah.
And that more or less worked. I didn't think it was a great movie.
No,
but again, it had an idea and it didn't seem out of place. But The Forever Purge, as we alluded to at the front of the episode, it's ham-fisted that they have to, like, basically retcon out the ending of the third movie. I mean, they acknowledged that the NFFA was out of power for a time, so it's not, obviously not a retcon in the traditional sense, but they're basically like, okay, never mind, fuck that, they're back.
Right.
What the fuck? What was the goddamn point of the third movie then? Why did we even have this? You just wrote yourself into a corner, James DeMonaco.
Like, right. Well, you ended your trilogy one way, and then so often when you relaunch a franchise, you have to reestablish the status quo in a way that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, to his credit, I guess, I mean, if you're being charitable, you could say, well, this is all about the folly of electoral politics. You know, it's not really a permanent safeguard against anything, which is true enough. It doesn't make that newscaster speech any less sloppy at the beginning. However, what I like is that he seems to realize that just reinstalling the new founding fathers is boring, because then he has that status quo disintegrate fairly quickly. So at least he gets away from it in a fairly expeditious manner. He doesn't like linger. It's not just like back to basics. So the movie has that going for it. But yeah, just putting them back in power is a pretty unimaginative way to get the franchise rolling again.
And there was a stretch where I thought that maybe the idea was the NFFA kind of astroturfed the bad guys into existence.
Well, the movie invokes that idea more than once, that it might not be as spontaneous as it looks.
Kind of in the way all the chaos is forced into being in the first Purge prequel movie. They're trying to accomplish their goals
with the same kind of chicanery.
Right.
Because they've gotten away with it
before. Wipe out this minority, that minority, these people, this group of people, this socioeconomic class. Wipe them out, or at least cause enough chaos so that they can implement martial law. And this is what they wanted all along. They wanted a totalitarian state.
Right.
And again, that wouldn't have been groundbreaking either, but that might have been more interesting than just, oh, well, look at all these rednecks who hate blacks and Mexicans. We can read the newspaper. Like, this is out there.
Unlike some of the villains in this movie.
Right. This is out there right now. I mean, it's topical, but to the point of blandness. So that's what I was talking about earlier when I'm like, it's marginally more interesting to keep drawing attention to the fact that people who seem more refined, whose bigotry is not so transparent, to continue to shine light on their misdeeds and their wrongdoing.
Right,
because then just be pointing to these poor rednecks who are bigoted because they don't know any better.
Right, yeah, these benighted salt of the earth people, which is, you know, I've been tired of that narrative since 2016.
Mm.
All those what the fuck happened op-eds.
Right.
Well, yeah, maybe they're saving that twist. Oh, they wanted martial law all along. This is their end game. Maybe they're saving that for the next Purge, which I can only assume is going to be called the forever Purge. Because what the fuck else are you going to call it?
Or the Never Purge.
The Never Purge. Ooh, one word. That's kind of, that's got a ring to it. I don't know. I guess I could call it the Forever Purge 2. Never Ending Story got sequels. Why the hell not?
Two of them, even.
But yeah, I mean, you say that they're all rednecks, and they are. But I think the movie does, and this is not a point in the movie's favor. If it sounds like I'm disagreeing with you, it's only to pick a different bone, or because I have a different bone to pick. It does try to play both sides of the aisle a little bit, just with the one Bolshevik, or proletariat as we've been calling him. There's like a little bit of that, where you get extreme Marxist kind of purgers, or there's one guy, and this is the littlest detail, just made me laugh out loud. Jim can attest to this. There's this one guy in El Paso who comes barging out of the shadows at them going, yeah, revolution! And, and then just gets blown off the face of creation. And he doesn't even get a whole word out. He gets all but one syllable of the word revolution out. But just the way he says it sounds hippy-dippy. You know, he does not sound like an NRA kind of a patriot, kind of a cold dead hand sort of guy. He sounds more like, yeah, stick it to the man, that kind of revolution. Not like a peace love beatnik kind of a guy, obviously, because he's here to crack skulls. But just something about that moment, I just imagined like good old boys getting a kick out of that. Like, yeah, you show that, pinko.
Right.
I don't know. They are hedging their bets a little bit, and
a little bit.
Yeah, no, the both sidesism is not that egregious. It's not as bad as this is a video game, not a movie. But like Bioshock Infinite really annoyed me in that regard. The slavers and then the revolutionaries were held in more or less equal contempt,
right,
by the game's protagonist and by the game's creators, we infer. This is not quite to that same degree, because basically all of this, yeah, revolution, or, you know, all of the sort of sub-Marxist stuff gets washed away the second the, I guess, main antagonist shows. It's way too late for him to rear his head, I think. The guy who shows up in El Paso, who's introduced, he literally says bad hombres out loud.
He does.
So, like, once that happens, and he calls his wife mother, which is a Mike Pence thing.
Right.
You know, he calls her incessantly, especially after she's been shot. You know, oh, mother, no, no, mother.
Mother is only on screen for about 3 minutes, and he throws the term out half a dozen times.
So certainly once he shows up, then we're fully into Dixie Fried Yeehaw, redneck villain territory. And yeah, everything else I've brought up kind of falls by the wayside. The only reason a grown man, you should only say mother as a grown ass man if you're Daffy Duck and a calamity is about to befall you.
Mother.
If an anvil is about to land on your head and you're Daffy Duck, you're allowed to say mother. Other than that, strike it from your vocabulary.
Yeah, mom will suffice. Yeah, then in that case, you say it to your own mother.
Right.
Not to your wife. Jesus Christ.
Now, the redneck hate is tempered a little bit by the guy's redemption arc.
Dylan.
Yes, by the rancher's son's redemption arc. He has a speech, or a conversation, I guess, a sort of stilted one, because they don't really speak the same language, with Juan when they're on the road at night headed for El Paso.
Right.
Shortly
before they get waylaid temporarily by the bikers.
Yeah, by the Fury Road set piece that wasn't to be. He basically says, I don't hate your kind, but birds of a feather, you know, classic racist cop-out. And he's not really challenged on it by Juan or the movie.
Yeah, Juan's like, you might be right. Juan even says,
you might be right.
I don't know.
I hope you're only allowing for that possibility because it's a life or death situation and you just don't want to make a scene or rock the boat, because if this were just a normal peacetime meeting of the minds, that idea is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But basically what Juan says is, well, you may be right, but we're in this together now. And, you know, that speaks to a certain practical reality, you know, like it or not. America's a melting pot. We have to do our best. But even just abstract, philosophically, that idea should get some pushback, I think. And it just never does.
No, not really. And instead, it's papered over by facile, well, now we've bonded over a life or death experience, so I'm not a racist anymore.
And now we get our pissing match culminates in both of us doing lasso tricks with equal expertise. So now you're my equal. That was also a little bit facile. Now, the one thing I do like about his characterization is we don't get a lot of this in American movies. He's sort of the archetypal son who wound up more racist than the father somehow.
Mm.
Like, anomalously racist.
Right.
Obviously, the classic example of this is John Turturro in Do the Right Thing,
mm-hmm.
where Danny Aiello's like, I raised you better than this. What the fuck happened to you? Ed Norton, I guess, in American History X would be another extreme example.
Although his dad is pretty fucking racist.
I haven't seen that movie since I was in like high school. I don't even remember his dad being in the picture. I'm remembering his stepdad, right? I'm remembering his mom's boyfriend who he butts heads with.
Stepdad is Elliot Gould. Is Elliot right? Gould.
Uh-huh.
And he pushes back on him because, of course, Elliot Gould is
Jewish, right?
Jewish. But no, his biological father is a cop or something who, again, is one of those guys who probably, if he met a black person just out in the world, he'd be very polite and respectful, but just talked ungodly shit at the dinner table.
Yes.
In one particular scene in that movie.
I do remember that scene. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. All right, so forget that I invoked American History X. Do the Right Thing.
But yeah, Do the Right Thing definitely is.
So that's kind of interesting. Obviously, once the father bites the dust, there's no more of that dynamic. And so then his character kind of loses something for me.
Yeah.
Because there's no longer a sense in which the apple has fallen far from the tree.
The tree has been burned down.
Yes. And I have no idea if this was intentional. The most clever bit of writing in the entire movie is, you know, so we already talked about the purification vans on the prowl during Purge night. You know, we're going to disinfect you if we get our hands on you.
Right.
And then the next morning, the newscaster who's about to get a bullet to the brain is talking about how, you know, disinfectant crews are going around as we speak, cleaning up the neighborhood. And I thought, like, okay, those scenes are back to back or very nearly. So I thought that was kind of pointed, that like there's a sense in which, even though the morning after is comparatively tranquil and obviously the word is being used differently, you know, disinfecting, the same tension is in the air in just a somewhat milder form. You know,
right,
and so I thought, like, that's really sharp, actually, if it was on purpose. But it's so subtle, and this movie is usually so unsubtle that I don't know if it was. But I'm glad no one thought to take it out, at least. You know, accidents happen, and some of them are good accidents if you're lucky. So kudos for that. John Carpenter was fond of saying that his movies fall into two camps. He only makes two type of movies. I've heard him say this more than once. I'm paraphrasing. I don't remember the exact nomenclature, but he says that he either makes siege movies or quest movies. You know, either you're holed up in a place, you know, that would be Assault on Precinct 13, obviously, or The Thing.
Right.
In a different form, mutated form, you could say. Or it's a men on a mission, guy on a journey kind of a movie, which would be Escape from New York, for example. And The
Purge. Or John Carpenter's Vampires.
And when you were recounting the whole arc of the Purge franchise, I thought of this because the movies fall into different molds. You know, the first one is a siege movie, home invasion movie, less successful than the others that I've seen. It's your least favorite.
Yes.
And you've seen all of them. I imagine it would be mine as well. And then most of them fall more into the
quest.
The quest structure. And this one is no exception. We got to get to El Paso. It's basically the Warriors. And I feel like that's where this movie shines, particularly when they get to El Paso and their Ithaca, you know, if we're going to invoke the Odyssey, is within arm's reach. And they just need to clear that last hurdle. And so I was applauding this movie internally for like, fuck yes, this is not a siege movie. And then not 10 minutes later, they hole up in basically the actual Alamo. And I thought like, okay, that's why I said during the plot rundown, it's kind of funny that this is how the climax plays out, because the movie swerved left there when I very much wanted it to keep going right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to just become more of a Fury Road, razor sharp straight line kind of thing where they're just hauling ass and being pursued at breakneck speed, and instead everything kind of slows down, and like I said, the action gets a little muddy and a little murky in this dusty, dilapidated Alamo structure. Didn't much care for that. Thought that the villain's comeuppance wasn't that satisfying, just both because of the cowboy tricks, which I thought were silly, and also because, as I said, he shows up too late in the movie to really feel like he has the stature of a primary antagonist, even though the movie definitely treats him like one.
Yeah, primary antagonists have to come into play, I think, before the halfway point.
Even if he'd only shown up on some news broadcast the same way that the Native American dude did, that would have been something.
Or even if we just hear talk of him, if his presence is felt, even if he's not physically on screen, that is enough, because that is often the case with antagonists of this ilk. Villains, in the proper sense, you're not going to see them if they're a big deal until late.
Yeah, well, you know, like fucking George Washington wasn't on the front lines. The general is not the first to go down, you know, when the bullets start flying. So it would make sense to save him for the third act. But we do, yeah, I think getting to know him via reputation would have been one way to deal with it.
But he just seems to be another yokel. I mean, he seems to be
local chapter, maybe. Right.
So he's a minor functionary, but he's not, yeah. He doesn't have the heft.
He doesn't even seem like he's important enough to have had anything to do with the military base getting exploded in El Paso, which is his turf.
Right.
Doesn't seem like he really had a hand in that. So he's not really anybody.
Yeah.
He's got a crew that's loyal to him, but whatever.
Yeah. And given the tier he's at and the fact that he doesn't seem to have that kind of reach, the only way to have given him the proper villain heft to make that ending more satisfying is if he had been back in their hometown harassing them then and followed them all the fuck the way to El Paso.
Yeah, and then you're definitely getting into more of a Fury Road type of a thing. If they didn't want to do... Basically, if you're going to introduce him at the 11th hour, he's got to be really singular, really colorful. He's got to make an impression quickly. And he
makes no impression at all.
Yeah, just another bumpkin.
Who calls his wife mother. God damn it.
I do like, you know, and certainly the more anarchic Purge movies that play with a wider canvas also did this. But I think this one does it the most explicitly, you know, by extending the Purge, by having it spill over onto the day after. The first Purge movie, in addition to all of its other problems, it's just boring because you get the sense that a family that has its ducks in a row, Purge night wouldn't ruffle their feathers that much. I mean, the reason the shit hits the fan in that first Purge movie is because one of the family members has a lapse of judgment and, like, compromises their security to let in, like, a wounded nobody who, like, comes to their door asking for help. So it's a moment of weakness, a moment of conscience that sort of exposes a crack in their otherwise airtight, watertight, bulletproof facade. You know, they live in this locked-down compound, much like the well-to-do family in this movie. And I like that in this movie we see that Purge Night is kind of not a big deal for people like the ranchers. You know, they're playing board games. What Purge Night is has to change in order to make them and therefore us start quaking in our boots. But I also like it has it both ways, because it also shows that less well-to-do people, less well-heeled Texans do have reason to be afraid, although they also have some recourse. There it's just more community built. They have to depend on one another and hire security and just kind of say a prayer. But they also get through the night unscathed. So there's a sense, it's clever because it speaks to the way in which franchise fatigue has set in for any long-running horror franchise. You need to mix up the playbook, because by the time you get to the fifth outing, whatever the initial hook was is probably not cutting it anymore. You got to give Jason Voorhees superpowers. Got to have him struck by a magic bolt of lightning and come back as a zombie. Well, that was the sixth one. But all the fifth one also mixes it up in kind of kooky ways.
This really sucks.
It sucks on so many levels. Jason X, a timeless classic. But yeah, the fact that no one's that pressed about Purge Night in this movie is sort of funny in a meta way. And I think that's my final plaudit, my last scrap of praise. It was an okay movie, by and large.
Yeah, it was fine. Obviously,
it's sort of cynically calibrated to be for a Hispanic audience, the way that the last one was very much targeted at an African-American demographic. And that feels a little pandering to me, although it's not the worst pandering I've seen. By any means, it's sort of this praise is slightly too high. If you know me, I almost wanted to say it's the Paranormal Activity, the Marked Ones of the Purge franchise, insofar as it's for Latinos and also the most fun. But I actually can't speak to that. I don't know if it's the most fun because I haven't seen two of the good ones.
Yeah, I would say Anarchy's more fun.
I'll have to take your word for it for the time being. I'll do a double feature one of these days.
Yeah.
So we complained about how the crowd was a little bit rowdy tonight. It's maybe the right atmosphere to see a Purge movie in. I think a Purge movie is best appreciated in an atmosphere of ugly, stupid Americans reacting the wrong way to the wrong parts.
Well, okay.
Ideally in a movie theater environment that could literally kill you because that Delta variant doesn't fuck around, apparently. Although everyone in the theater, myself included, was unmasked. And really, if you're going to wear a mask to the movies, newest Purge flick is probably the one you want to wear it to, just to get into the spirit of the thing. Make you feel like you're ready to go out to the streets and dispense psycho clown justice.
Well, I think it's one thing if you've got a somewhat boisterous crowd who reacts when there's a kill on screen or shit like, oh, you know, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe even, like, laughing at an inopportune moment or whatever. But the fucking guys in a row behind us were just, like, perpetually yammering. And that's, you know, I don't care what context you're in, what movie you're watching. That's just poison all the time.
Yeah. A slightly, very slightly touching moment happened on my way out of the theater. I was right behind the pack of them. And just during the whole pandemic, I got in the habit of just opening doors with my elbows or my feet. And I kind of can't unlearn it. He let the door swing into my face, and I like caught it with my arm just as a reflex, like with my elbow, because that's how I open doors now, just as a matter of course, not manually if I can help it. And he must have thought that the door like hit me or something, or like caught me unawares. Little did he know I was doing that intentionally, again, just force of habit. And he was like, oh, sorry. And I said, oh, no, don't worry about it. So he's not a complete jackal. He has some decency.
He was just raised by jackals and doesn't know that he's not supposed to talk in the fucking movie.
Yeah, right, exactly. So anyway, I bring up the kind of rowdy atmosphere of this screening. All to say, if you're looking for more of a quiet, contemplative art house kind of an atmosphere, might I recommend Time of the Wolf, which is a Michael Haneke film from 2003. I think it's one of his best, and you almost never hear about it. I like it more than Funny Games, more than Amour, more than a lot of his flicks, more than White Ribbon. It's really excellent, really underrated. It's about... It's I haven't seen The Road. I have read The Road, Cormac McCarthy. It's Cormac McCarthyan in its despair and in its depiction of a desolate post-apocalyptic wasteland. It's not quite as blighted as the milieu in The Road. It's not quite as sparsely populated. There's still some infrastructure, but it's really threadbare, really hard scrabble. Much of the tension in that movie arises from the moral and legal gray area that everyone has found themselves in. It's like if you commit a murder in Time of the Wolf, you will get in trouble, maybe if you get caught, but like you probably won't. And a big chunk of the movie and most of the stakes in the movie come from the protagonists trying to bring this guy to justice, and it's not at all clear. Even after they've pointed the guy out and gone, they go, he did such and such. I saw him do it with my own eyes. It's not clear where the justice is going to come from, like what the governing body is. Everything has disintegrated to the point where there might be some kind of law and order, but who knows what it's going to look like. And that's a really interesting sort of no man's land to set your movie in. It's not complete anarchy. You know, it's not like every man for himself, but it's getting there, and it's going to get worse before it gets better, most likely. It doesn't really seem like society is reconstituting itself. It's more like you're watching a last gasp. Very arty. It's, you know, Michael Haneke. It's a little Bergman-esque in its despair, kind of Tarkovsky a little bit with the visual desolation, kind of Stalker. It's excellent, excellent stuff, and one of the unsung, I think, post-apocalyptic movies of recent years, although not that recent. It came out damn near 20 years ago. But definitely an underrated flick from that particular director. So I would say check that one out. And I've already seen that one, so my homework is the remaining two Purge movies on my to-do list.
And what do you know? My recommendation is a double feature of Purge 2 and 3.
There you have it.
Because I'm trying to hew a little bit closer to theme with my recommendations this time around. I went a little bit further afield in our last episode.
Yeah, we so often do.
And credit where credit's due to James DeMonaco, this premise is a little bit sui generis. There's not a lot of movies out there like it where there's mandated timed chaos.
Yeah.
You invoked The Warriors, where New York City has just kind of descended into chaos. And speaking of John Carpenter, Escape from New York,
yep,
there's some of that energy too. Both good movies to watch, incidentally. But nevertheless, just the concept of The Purge is a little bit just its own thing. And so I'm going to recommend what I think are the two best movies in a 5-film so far franchise.
Ever?
And yeah, they work best as a double feature because they're the latter two films in a trilogy for which I think the first film is disposable, both because it's bad and also because it doesn't play into the dynamics that really, I think, define this premise. And also, the characters aren't connected, whereas Frank Grillo plays the cop/ex-cop character that I mentioned in Anarchy, and he also plays the head of security to this presidential candidate. Same character. This guy has become head of security for this politician.
Did not know that.
So there is also carryover between the two movies in a way that there isn't across any other pair or subset of these movies. So, yeah, watch Purge Anarchy and Election Year together, as I believe Matt eventually intends to do. Well, I guess this is as good a time as any to wrap things up. So I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from the Forever Purge official trailer HD, uploaded by Universal Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, August 1st, and we will be discussing Escape Room Tournament of Champions, which follows the survivors of the original film competing against other such survivors. See you then.